Hello and welcome to the Catholic Bishops Conference of England and Wales podcast. I'm your host, Finn Shiner, and today we have the great honour and privilege of speaking to Sister Helen Alford, who since 2023 has been the president of the Pontifical Academy of Social Sciences, founded in 1994 by St. John Paul II to enrich the Holy See's engagements with issues related to the Church's social doctrine. Sister Helen, a Dominican nun, was born in London and has a PhD in engineering from Cambridge University. I'm extremely excited to be speaking to Sister Helen today. So firstly, I'd just like to say thank you very much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to speak to us, Sister Helen.
It's a pleasure, Finn.
The first question then I'd like to ask is, what would you say is a Catholic approach to the social sciences, and how does that differ from other approaches?
Okay, that's a really interesting question. Well, let me start off by saying what the goals are of the Pontifical Academy of Social Sciences, as set up in the statutes which were given to us by Pope John Paul II, as you said. He set up the academy. And we got three goals. Our first goal is to promote social sciences, and especially it says four of them: economics, sociology, law, and political science. And then we have two other goals. One of them is to help the church apply the social teaching to current social problems. And the third one is to help the church develop the social teaching in dealing with new social problems or new developments in the world. So you can see from that if you think about our first one, we're about promoting the social sciences. In a real sense, you could say, well, we want the best kind of social knowledge there can be. So we want to try to make the social sciences as good and as rigorous and as helpful to resolving problems as they can be. So in some senses, we'd say we want to promote the knowledge of the social sciences. There's also a sense in which, as you can see from those other two goals, that the church wants to find ways to make the social teaching come alive, to be part of the solution of problems. Because we could say that the social teaching is a kind of an application of what Gaudium et Spes in number 22 says. Christ reveals the human person to themselves. There's a sense in which what we have in the Christian revelation is a guide for society, because Christ is showing us how human beings really could be, you know, if they weren't sinful, if they weren't weak. So the church can sort of give a guide in that sense to the social sciences. And I gave a talk not that long ago to the International Federation of Catholic Universities in which I tried to say, look, we Catholic universities, we should be leading, especially in the social sciences. And if you look back historically, you can see how Catholic thinkers were often ahead of the social sciences. It's about this promoting the social sciences, I would say, is a really Catholic thing for us to do.
Right. So it's about understanding the social sciences are inherently bound up with what being a Catholic is.
I would say they're a sort of a continuation of philosophy. If you look at the history of the social sciences, they're all children of philosophy, if you like, and they are kind of born out of the side of philosophy because of how much more complicated human life became after the Industrial Revolution and after the French Revolution. These are the two big changes that take place in modern society, and they generate a lot of new things, and people need to understand these better. So, you know, philosophers used to look at the things, and they still do to some extent, that the social sciences look at now. But we needed something more developed to look at social relations, to look at economic relations, to understand how politics is working, this sort of thing. We didn't need to be so sophisticated about those before. But as life became more complex, we needed deeper forms of knowledge, and especially more empirical forms of knowledge, to help us understand what's going on. And you can even see this in the church, because Some people would say social teaching has a long history, but usually we say social teaching starts with Rerum Novarum at the end of the 1800s. And although there are earlier thinkers who contribute to the launch of that teaching, so it's not like the church starts only in 1891, because there were people doing all kinds of things before, even if they weren't popes, they are reacting to this new situation. So Catholic social teaching is the sort of church's response to this modern situation, just like sociology is a response, and economics is a response, and political science is a response. Everybody has to try to understand what's going on better and try to respond to the problems better.
So there's a couple of things that I'd like that are really interesting what you just said. But first, you talked about how they're all the different social sciences are kind of like the child of philosophy.
Yeah.
So does that mean that if there's a sort of overriding philosophy in society, then you'll see that play out in all these different areas that the social sciences investigate? And if that's the case, what would you say is the overriding philosophy that we're kind of dealing with today, and how does that manifest itself in, say, economics or political science?
Yeah, well, that's also a really excellent question, because that's true. We do have a kind of, we could say philosophy, we could say a mindset, we could say a worldview, something like this, which comes to be dominant, to be mainstream at the time these things are happening. So this is a sort of the beginning of modernity. You know, historians would call this the beginning of modernity. It's starting in the 1700s. We start seeing the Industrial Revolution really taking off in 1770 or 1760, 1770. Then the end of the 1700s, we have French Revolution. So this is the really kind of important period where these new things start. And this is a period immediately after the Reformation, after the wars of religion, where people are trying to search for a new way of thinking about the world. And one of the really crucial things they do, which is different from all philosophical systems before, except for a few very marginal ones, so no mainstream philosophy is like this before, they start focusing on individual human freedom as the center of the whole scheme of things. And then they want to build all their rest of their knowledge around this. But this is the central kind of starting point. Whereas all philosophies before that had been always focused on the group, the human group. You know, we talked about the image of the body, you know, and the king was at the top, and then you had the aristocrats, and you had the soldiers, and you had the merchants, and they all had their place in the body. And so you thought about the body politic, you know, these terms we used, you know. Whereas in the modern period, that gets replaced. It gets sort of like turned on its head, and the individual becomes central. And that's done for some good reasons at the time, historical reasons, but they're not all good. And certainly they create a series of, I would say, unexpected collateral effects, which are really negative. I mean, we could see, for instance, the environmental crisis beginning with this change. In one sense, it allows all kinds of new possibilities for individuals. They can make choices that were more difficult for them to make before, and that's in itself an interesting thing. But we start to be much, much more disconnected from the natural world around us and much more focused on my decision about what I want to do for myself. And you can see how, especially when we see the effect of that in economics, how we can start becoming disconnected from the pollution we're causing, disconnected from the damage we're causing to the world around us. You do see some of it in the literary people, like Charles Dickens' books, you know, in the 1800s. The writers, the people producing cultural artifacts, the romantic movement in art and that sort of thing, they're reacting against some of these things. They want to put nature back in this, or they want to put the good of human society back on the table over against, you know, usually the rich and powerful people in society just doing what they want. But anyway, this is the complex inheritance that we have. And now the social sciences are really, really rooted in this idea of the goal of society being to maximize individual human freedom. And you see that reflected in the way they think, in their theories, in the way they run their research programs and that kind of thing. And it's becoming more and more problematic. It always was a bit problematic from the point of view of the church, but it's becoming very problematic in general, especially in the face of the environmental crisis.
I know you've talked a lot about how something called relationality. Would that be something that you'd like to sort of maybe not replace the overriding philosophy with, but at least challenge it with? If that's the case, could you tell us a little bit more about what relationality actually is and what it means?
Yeah. So I think this is part of the solution to the problem that we have now. We don't want to go back. We don't want to say everything that happened in modernity was wrong. We absolutely don't want to do that because there were some real gains that were made. For instance, the whole discussion about human rights. This is a modern discussion and it's a very, very important gain for humanity that we have this. But we need to move on from it because it's too, we could say, the idea of the human being in modernity is too reductionist. It's too limited because we are actually deeply relational beings. And we see this more and more in the social research that's being produced, ironically. The most clear example of it is in the happiness research. You know, we've had world happiness reports produced. You can just go online and find them for about the last 10 years. And they are collecting data on happiness all around the world. So this is really interesting because when you get data from across the world, if you can find relationships, correlations between various aspects of it, you can be pretty sure that you're looking at something that's about what it means to be human. Because if it's the same in every culture, then we're not talking about cultural differences. We're talking about something that's important about being human. And one of the things that the happiness data shows us is that across the world, it doesn't matter what culture you're in. If you're really poor and you increase your income, you increase your happiness. Now, that would be consistent with saying, okay, well, I'm an individual. I get more freedom if I get more income. I can buy more things. I can do more things. So that part of the happiness data seems to coincide with us being individuals and having individual needs. But the next thing you find is that once people get to a relatively low level of income compared to the average in their particular part of the world, we're not talking about high level of income, but somewhere near the average, but usually a bit below the average, this connection between increase in income an increase in happiness breaks down. We don't see it anymore. And what correlates much more with increases in happiness is the quality of relationships. So you can see here quite interesting results, sociological results, showing us that there is a sense in which we are individuals, and we see it especially when we're poor. You know, that we need things for me as an individual. I don't have enough to eat. I don't have a good enough house to live in. I don't have enough health care, these sorts of things. So people need things individually when they're poor. But once we get beyond that sort of basic survival level, much more important for our happiness is the relationships that we have. And when we say relationships here, we're not just talking about, you know, we could say you go into a shop, you buy something, you have a transaction. There's a kind of a relationship there, but it's a sort of relationship that doesn't have any meaning beyond I get something that's important for me. You know, I get my food, I get my whatever I need. You know, that's what we call transactional relationships. It's based around transactions. The kind of relationality that I'm talking about here that doesn't figure in the modern worldview is what we could call intrinsic relationality. It's where the relationships are important in themselves. What the happiness data is showing us now is important to us. So these are the relationships where I don't have or build this relationship just to get something for me. The relationship is important in itself. You know, we can think about marriages, we can think about friendships, we can think about maybe other kinds of relationships as well. And we need to bring that aspect of our relationality into our theories and into our social models. Because at the moment, we're making policies, we're making decisions, we're gathering data on the basis of theories that don't include that. And that is giving us not the best information. We're being guided by information which is not as good as it could be. And we can make better decisions about policy and society and think better about our lives if we included our relationality in our way of thinking about the world, in our worldview. And that's one of the ways in which we need to move beyond modernity and a way in which Catholic social teaching can help us do that.
So it's sort of keeping what's good about the modern world, but trying to have more an emphasis on how we as human beings are no man's an island, essentially.
Yeah.
And that we're,
yeah,
we need to have those relationships. So could you give me an example of something in modernity in the sphere of social sciences which doesn't have that emphasis as you see it, and how that might be changed? Like, it doesn't have that relational aspect.
Yeah, well, I mean, economics is the most clear type of science that we have today that shows this. You know, it's quite interesting, and we don't have much time to talk about this, but actually, economics started off, if you look at Adam Smith and some of the early economists, with a more relational idea than we have now. Economics has actually got worse in this sense. It's actually become far more focused on purely individual wants and needs than it was 200 years ago or so. But anyway, this is another point. Anyway, the situation we're dealing with now is that we have economic theories which can't deal with our intrinsic relationality, and they lead us to make poor decisions about things. You know, they lead to decisions about the way we organize work, for instance, which are purely based on how much money everybody's going to get out of the system. And we're finding more and more, I mean, we saw this after the pandemic, so many young people not wanting to go back to work because they didn't want anymore to be part of a system like that. They want to be part of something, a work system, where their dignity is more recognized, and dignity is also a very relational category, where they're more building something which has some sense of purpose. And this is also another aspect of economics that I'm bringing in now. It doesn't have any goals for the economy other than just to produce as much money as possible. And this is not very intelligent in the world that we're in. We need to have a purpose for our businesses and our economic system that makes sense for people. It needs to help us live a better human life. So this is another thing which will be another element from Catholic social teaching alongside the relationality, which we need to try and bring more into the social sciences and into the modern worldview as well.
So more of an emphasis on human flourishing.
Yeah, and we can do it. We've got lots of examples of businesses that have tried to do this, of other kinds of organizations, but especially business. Businesses are the best example to use because they're the ones where people think it's the least likely to happen. We've got now things that we call social enterprises. They are making money, but they are also trying to produce a social outcome. And they're quite successful, many of them. We also have other kinds of businesses, some of them being advised in UK now by a thing called Blueprint for Better Business, which was set up on the basis of Catholic social teaching as a result of the financial crisis, when all the businesses were thinking, what are we doing wrong? We need to look for some different ideas. We need some help from somewhere else. And they started getting interested in, especially Pope Benedict's social encyclical, which came out then, Caritas in Veritate. So Blueprint was set up as part of that. Now Blueprint is advising the FTSE 100 companies, advising Vodafone, EasyJet, NatWest, to help these businesses to try to bring in more of a sense of purpose and more of a sense of business as a set of human relations. The relationality side is there too. So these things are starting to happen on the ground. They haven't yet hit the theories, because often theories are behind practice. We need to change the practice first, and then the academics start reflecting on the practice and thinking about how they can get it into their theories. So that's where a place like the Academy of Social Sciences could help social sciences, help try to translate the practice into the theory, which then starts to help the practice to work better.
Well, that leads me to one of my other questions, actually, because you've referenced a couple of times about empirical data. And I know that you said previously in another interview that you wanted to sort of use the resources of data to help tell the church's story, which I think is really interesting, because obviously data is really permeating all different areas of life. And I was just really curious about like how you'd see that play out, sort of using data to tell the story of the gospel, the values of the gospel.
Well, I mean, let me give you a couple of stories first, which I hope help to illuminate the importance of this. When Pope Francis was elected, some non-Catholics said to me, this was shortly after he'd been elected, he hadn't been able to do anything much. They said to me, oh, Pope Francis is revolutionizing Catholic Church. And I said, he hasn't revolutionized anything. All that's happening is that you're seeing a face of the Catholic Church you never saw before. It was there, but you didn't see it. And then another thing I would like to say is, you know, if we go out on the street in London or in somewhere else in the UK and just stop someone on the street and say, what do you think of, first three things you think of when you hear the words Catholic Church, what would they say? Maybe it wouldn't be so good. But what they could be saying is, biggest provider of education in sub-Saharan Africa, much bigger provider of AIDS care compared to the proportion of Catholics in the world. You know, we're punching above our weight in terms of the AIDS care that we give. Major contributor to improvements in human development in the key parts of the world where that's important. You know, these kinds of things. Don't say that because they don't know about it. And they don't know about it because we're not telling them that story. Now, this has started. It's not like we're starting from zero. There are some interesting resources. For instance, there's a website which I'd like to tell your listeners about called globalcatholiceducation.org, globalcatholiceducation.org, which has now four reports on global Catholic education. It's using the data that's collected by the Holy See. It has a statistics office inside the Secretariat of State, and the statistics are gathered by the nuncios and sent into that office every year, and they produce a statistical yearbook. And so a couple of guys from UNESCO in their own time produce this global Catholic education report using data from this office. And I've already been able to use the data in these reports in talking to, say, the British ambassador to the Holy See, or talking to people from the EU, or talking to people from the UN. If you start having data, sources of data and reports that give a narrative that's connected with the data, you start talking to people who are interested in this stuff, and that people start to see what the church is doing. Because right now, it's kind of hidden from most people. It's such a big group. We're nearly 1.4 billion people in the world, and a heck of a lot of things are being done by people in the church, but most other people don't know anything about it. So I see it as important for us we need to know more about what the church is doing. I think it's important for also gaining funds. A lot of religious orders and NGOs and Caritas and, you know, they're doing a huge amount of work, and funders need to know about this. I had a discussion not that long ago with people from the Bill Gates Foundation, and they know very well that they are not very good at what's called the last mile. They are not very connected with the very poor people, whereas the Catholic organizations are really well connected, the sisters especially, but often other organizations as well. So they can see now they should be connecting with Catholics who can help them do parts of what they want to do, which is they're not very good at. So this message is beginning to get out slowly, but we need to use it a lot more. And the last thing I would say is it's really important for evangelization, because in today's world, people are impressed if they can see this sort of thing. And they think, well, where is this coming from? Why are these people doing this? You know, and they start to ask themselves questions and they want to know more. And that gets them interested in the church. You know, I sometimes say to people, some people don't like this, but I hope you can see why I say it, that giving people this kind of data is a bit like the miracles that Jesus did when he was alive. He was showing people that God was here, the kingdom of God was present. And this kind of data shows people something's happening, something's real here. So I think it's really important. I think we can do a lot more on it. I think the more we do, the more we start to speak the language of the modern world. It's huge in sports. It's huge in governments. It's huge in all kinds of places. It could be huge in the Catholic Church, because we certainly have the basis for telling that story using data. We just actually have to start collecting the data, using it, creating reports, all that sort of stuff.
That's fascinating. I mean, I know the church does a lot for human trafficking.
Right.
I guess the suggestion is if you could sort of show that in cold, hard facts.
Yeah.
You show that to someone and they think, wow, that's interesting. That's impressive. Why do they do that? And ultimately, if they keep asking themselves why they do that, they'll realize that it all comes from Jesus's message in the gospel to help other people and help the needy. And it might make them think, well, maybe there's something in that. Maybe Jesus had something
right.
Really interesting to say that's still relevant today.
Absolutely, Finn. I think that's exactly what is likely to happen. People are not stupid. If they get this kind of information, they start thinking about it.
Yeah, and it made me think about what you were talking about, these studies on happiness. I mean, the church has traditionally been associated with, you know, an emphasis on family values and community values and stuff. And if that's what these happiness studies are showing, that people are happier when they have stronger relationships, I think, again, it has a similar effect and shows that these values that the church preaches has a tangible effect in your life. It's not all just kind of highfalutin sort of esoteric stuff. It's actually going to have a tangible impact in your life.
I think you're right. And I think that is another source of data, which is really important, because it's not coming from the church. It's not controlled by the church. This is being done by researchers who are nothing to do with the church, but they're coming up with results which really converge with the kind of teaching the church has. So this is another way of showing that, as Gaudium et Spes says, Christ does reveal something to us about who we are. And it's not a surprise that when you get really good data sources coming out, they start converging with Christian teaching. It shouldn't be a surprise to us.
Yeah. What you've been talking about as well, in terms of speaking in a language that people understand today, it makes me think of that saying from Vatican II about, you know, reading the sign of the times.
Right, right.
And it's making me think, as someone who works in communications within the church, it's my job to be telling these stories.
great. Well, we should work together on it.
Yeah, 100%. I'd love to. So just a little bit of a pivot. I know you've talked a lot about technology and the impact technology can have on society. And obviously the big issue, the big technological issue everyone is talking about today with a lot of anxiety is artificial intelligence. What unique contribution does Catholic social teaching have in that particular debate?
Well, I think, again, we need a sort of illumination that the church can give, that Catholic social teaching can give, but we also need to work on the basic ethical level, which is about being human. I mean, if we think God is the creator before he's the redeemer, we would expect what's good on a human level, philosophical level, to be illuminated by and confirmed and raised up by revelation and by the teaching of Christ, but not to be fundamentally changed by it. So we can work at both these levels, both at the level of what our faith is teaching us and also at the level of what's good from on a philosophical level, ethical level for human beings. I think the first thing I would like to say is that the situation we have with AI is just a continuation of the situation we've had with technology, at least since the Industrial Revolution. Because what came to the fore there was a type of technological development which is what we could call technocentric. It's a kind which another thinker in this field has called adversarial technology. I mean, if you look at the way it's been developed, it's always been taking the skills out of people's jobs. It's been taking jobs away from people. And now with AI, it even seems to be taking the human person out of the governance of things, or, you know, even the intellectual side of things. Now, the first thing I want to say is technological development doesn't have to be like that. You know, we can find other phases in human history, and we can also formulate a way of thinking about technological development, which is what we could call human-centered, that enhances human skill, that could actually make human jobs more interesting, more rich, more full, more human, if you like. So technology can be devised in more than one way. The big tech entrepreneurs who are making huge amounts of money out of this existing way of producing technology, they're going to say what I'm saying is against technological development. But it's not against technological development. It's another kind of development. We should be in favor of technological development because that's about creating a more rich life. That's using our creativity to make possible human beings to do more things. The trouble with the way AI is being developed is it's not being developed that way. So what do we do? Well, we need to do what basically we've always done. The big principle in dealing with technology since the Industrial Revolution has been solidarity. If you look at the way workers reacted to what was happening to them in the workplace, they stopped things happening, they got laws changed, they got improvements in their salaries and in their conditions and things by pulling together, by using solidarity. Solidarity is a really, really powerful tool. We saw it also in Poland, which brought down the communist regime before. So I think on the one hand, that the current developments in AI are very worrying. I think I share the concern that people have about that. On the other hand, we have tools to deal with this. If we really pull together, if we started to talk about the way AI is being developed in the kinds of language that I'm using as a sort of adversarial technology, which could be redirected in another way, if we started to get legal systems and social systems to react to it, we can change the direction of this technology. It's been done before, it can be done again. Of course, it's harder and harder to do it the more this technology is developing. I mean, it's a bit like, in that sense, and lots of people make this analogy, the difference between conventional weapons and nuclear weapons. You know, once we moved to nuclear weapons, we created a whole new type of problem for ourselves, which we still haven't really been able to resolve. Now, AI could well become something like that, a kind of a nuclear weapon that is very hard to control. But we can control it. And I don't want to say, you know, it's a bit like you can have positive and useful uses of nuclear technology as well as nuclear weapons. I would say we can have AI, which is really helping the development of society, helping human beings move forward, but we can also have this very negative form, which is being actively developed right now. It's difficult to see how we can see it in a positive way. We can maybe control it, a bit like we control nuclear weapons. But I don't want to say we shouldn't be in favor of AI development, because I think we can have human-centered forms of AI development. So I think these would be the two kind of key things, I would say, coming out of Catholic social teaching. One is that we need to always put the human person at the center. That's the main message we get from Catholic social teaching. We can put the human person at the center with technological development as well, including AI development. But the other thing is to deal with the negative sides of technological development. So dealing with the negative forms of AI, we need to really awaken solidarity. We have, for instance, lots of ethical frameworks that have been developed. The EU's developed them, UNESCO's developed them. There's lots and lots of them. It's not like we don't have the tools for doing it. We have to actually make sure it happens. And that's where the solidarity, I think, comes in.
I guess it goes back to your earlier point about the relationality. Is our development of AI taking that integral aspect of the human being into consideration? Is it going to harm our relationality, or is it going to increase it?
And also our relationality is the means we can use to try to stop it doing that through our solidarity, through our building a common good together, waking up to how we belong to each other. We can control the trajectory of technology, technological development. It isn't in control of us. We control it. It's our tool. The big tech guys will try to give you the impression that it's got a life of its own, and they know what's going on, and they will carry on doing it. But it's not actually like that. We can control this, at least for now. We could get to a situation somewhere, perhaps, like the atomic bomb situation, but we're certainly way away from that right now. And we could direct this, instead of having to try to stop something which is being negative for us, we could instead use all that energy, use all those capable engineers that have a lot of capacity to start designing something which is for the human person, which is human-centered. We can do it. There are all kinds of ways already devised. There are centers in universities on human-centered technology. You know, we can do this kind of thing. We just have to choose to do it. And especially the key big businessmen who are running this sort of thing, which perhaps brings us back to Blueprint. We should send Blueprint over to talk to all those guys in Silicon Valley to actually do it. Often the real problem we have in society is a problem of will and a lack of courage to actually do the things that we know we could do that are the good things to do, but we feel it's too difficult, or for whatever reason, we can't do it.
So would you be in favour of this idea that's been floated a lot about having a pause on AI development and pressing pause on it whilst we kind of figure some of these things out?
I think that would be quite a sensible idea. I think that we need much more deliberation about it. We need people, society as a whole, to understand much more about it. So I think insofar as a pause could be used for that, I think it would be a very good thing. Because one of the things we know from all kinds of systems, for instance, it's quite old, this idea of a human-centered economy. There were people in the mid-20th century trying to develop this. One of the things they always said is that in a human-centered economy, growth isn't an end in itself. We need growth which works with the human being. So it's a sort of organic kind of growth. It's a growth that works with organic systems. We are part of nature. We have a sort of time frame that we gradually develop through. So a human-centered technological development should be inserted into a kind of organic system where people are part of its evaluation. They grow with it, if you like. Maybe for now, the only thing we could go for is a pause.
Yeah, well, it makes a lot of sense. I guess a question I had as we sort of come towards the end of this absolutely fascinating interview, it's been really, really interesting. You know, there's a lot of things we're talking about, which is kind of getting to the real heart of things in terms of the philosophy of the human being and, you know, what is good for the human being. You know, human flourishing to me could look very, very different to my friend who has a completely different conception of what human flourishing would be. So my question is, you know, we live in a society now where there's many, many different competing ideas of what is good and what is true and what's good for us. How do you kind of cut through that with some of these ideas? You know, we're not all necessarily coming at these questions from the same place. Many of us are actually coming at things from a very, very different place.
Well, I think we need to have time for people to have dialogue with each other and listen to each other and open up to each other, because in one sense, what you're saying is quite true. That's what people experience. But if we take a step back and think, going right back to what we said at the beginning of this discussion, that we're coming out of this period of modernity, which put human freedom and a subjective idea of this. So I decide for myself what I do for me at the center of things. And we've seen a whole series of negative effects coming from that. We need to rethink, in a sense, human freedom in a relational way, and rethink human freedom on the basis of the kind of being we are. We could think of it maybe more like a freedom for, freedom to become that person you would like to be, rather than freedom from. Nobody tells me what to do. This is a sort of negative kind of freedom. That's the dominant one that we have now. I decide for myself. Instead of thinking, what kind of person could I become? And that partly depends on the kind of being I am, which the social sciences is really helping us to understand. That happiness research, which I talked about, there are differences between the cultures. But when you get down to those basic correlations I was talking about with you, where poor people, you give them more income, they feel happier, but above a fairly low level, that correlation stops working and the correlation with relationships gets much more important. That is something about being human. And we have more and more data now about what does it mean to have human good, human flourishing. It's very basic. It's getting to the kind of level that in philosophy would have been called natural law in the past. That there are certain things which are just good about being human. Relationality was always seen as one of those. It was always seen that the human person is social and wants to be in relationship with other people. Another thing is reproduction, producing new members of our family and of our species. Another thing is relationship with God. It was also seen as part of our relationality. And in fact, although today we're in a world that feels very secular, people are really interested in all kinds of phenomena. Why is sci-fi films so interesting to people? So often it's about something coming from the outside to meet us. And I often say, you know, to people, well, the most amazing, strange being has already come 2,000 years ago. There's a sense in which we need to have freedom. This is part of the modern synthesis that we want to keep. Human freedom is good, but we need to rethink it in a relational environment and in relation to nature, that our decisions need to be sustainable in relation to other people and in relation to the natural world amongst us. So this is part of this deep change. You know, you were talking about these philosophical ideas we've been talking about. Pope Francis likes to say that we're not in an era of change. We're in a change of era. And that means really deep, really, really deep. So on the one hand, it looks like we all are very fragmented. And on the other hand, and we're sort of in a crisis. On the other hand, these deep changes are happening, and they represent a new opportunity and a new openness for us. If I want to perhaps leave your listeners with one sort of idea, it would be really take seriously Pope Francis's idea of the encounter and of the dialogue. Try to have a dialogue with people who are different from you in a deep level, listening to them, but also telling them. And I think you'd be really surprised how much in common you actually find, without disrespecting the differences. The differences are also important. Diversity is enriching. We're not against that. We're not against exercise of freedom, but we also need to find this deep commonality that we have to get beyond loneliness, to get beyond fear. So these are the kinds of tensions that we have, things that we're struggling with now, because I think we're in the middle of a birth of a new phase in history, which is really exciting and full of hope, but is also really scary and very hard to live with. There's a lot of suffering. As we know, birth has birth pangs. It's suffering as well as something new coming into life. We're in the middle of it right now. We experience that.
Wow. Thank you very much. I mean, I think what you're saying is very exciting. And, you know, there's opportunities, isn't there, for the church to make really important contributions to these big debates. And as these big changes are happening, you know, the church will be there. And, you know, that's exciting. And it's actually a real privilege to be part of that in a small way.
Absolutely.
A bit less small for you, I think it's fair to say, as the president.
Yeah, but I think everybody plays their part.
On that uplifting note, Sister Helen, it's been an absolute pleasure. I've really enjoyed talking with you. Really, really grateful. I'm sure the listeners will thoroughly concur. Look forward to speaking to you again.
Okay. Thank you. God bless you.
Thank you very much. Yeah.